here and now. On a busy Monday, the Supreme Court has issued a flurry of 5-4 decisions. We'll have that story. And in a moment, a security expert says if your child uses a cell phone to access the internet, someone could be hacking into that cell phone to spy on you. But first, 4 Iraqi tribal leaders allied with the U.S. were among the dozen people killed in a crowded hotel lobby in Baghdad today when a suicide bomber eluded security and detonated his belt of explosives. The attack was the 5th in a string of suicide bombings around Iraq today, killing at least 45 people. Tina Sussman covers Iraq for the Los Angeles Times. She joins us on the line. Tina, tell us about this meeting. Why were the sheikhs there?
Well, the tribal sheikhs, particularly these sheikhs, from Al-Anbar province, have been essentially holding a series of meetings all over the country. This is just one of several that have taken place in recent weeks as they join forces to oppose Al-Qaeda. Many of these sheikhs at one time actually harbored the Sunni insurgents in their areas, but in recent months they decided that it was time to stop that practice, so they began talking to the Iraqi government. They began working with U.S. forces. And this meeting, in which 4 sheikhs from Al-Anbar province were killed, appears to have just been another one of these gatherings. The sheikhs from Al-Anbar province are significant because it is Al-Anbar province which was the most troubled province at one time. And when the sheikhs there decided to switch loyalty, so to speak, to turn away from Al-Qaeda and work with the United States, they brought violence down dramatically. The United States, in turn, went to them and said, look, maybe you guys can convince other sheikhs elsewhere to follow this practice.
And it's early yet, but do you have a sense of how serious a setback this then is for that U.S. hope that this council would set an example for other tribes?
I think this attack, like so many others, is going to be seen as a setback but not a death notice for the effort. There have been many attacks on these sheikhs since they began working with the U.S. forces and cooperating with the Iraqi government. The difference with this attack is that it happened, you know, in central Baghdad, in this hotel where they were meeting. Normally, these attacks take place actually in the tribal sheikhs' own region. There have been many horrific attacks, for instance, on tribal sheikhs out in Al-Anbar province. Several have been killed in the last several months. Their families have been attacked. The fact that this attack took place here in Baghdad, it's scary. It certainly is a chilling reminder that insurgents can hit anywhere, even in a hotel which allegedly has a good, tight security system.
Well, we do want to ask you about that because we understand that the Mansour also houses the Chinese embassy. It's home to a number of Iraqi parliament members. Also killed today in the suicide bombing was a noted Iraqi poet, Rahim al-Maliki. So people are wondering, how is it that this suicide attacker got through not one, but 3 security checkpoints?
You have to remember that back in April, a suicide bomber got through checkpoints to get into the Iraqi parliament building and blow himself up. And the Iraqi parliament building has tight security and also happens to be within the green zone, which is supposed to be the safest place in Baghdad. The fact is that any hotel has a lot of different entrances. One of the theories that they had after the parliament attack was that the bombers had actually gotten through the kitchen entrance. So it's entirely possible that perhaps this attacker slipped in elsewhere.
Tina, anything else you feel we should know from today's 5 suicide bombings?
One of the other interesting bombings in northern Iraq, 18 people were killed when 2 vehicles laden with bombs attacked one of these joint security stations housing both American and Iraqi security forces. This is significant because joint security stations are really considered the linchpin of the counterinsurgency effort that the United States military has been pursuing here. These joint security stations essentially are, you know, small buildings or even abandoned houses located within residential neighborhoods where U.S. and Iraqi forces set up base together. The idea is that by having these troops in the Iraqi neighborhoods, locals will begin to build up relationships with them and feed them good intelligence to stop insurgents. However, these stations, because they're so vulnerable, often come under attack, and this is a good example 18 people were killed. There were several Americans reported injured in the incident. So it just goes to show, you know, yet another obstacle to this military surge and this counterinsurgency effort that's underway here.
Tina Sussman, covering Iraq for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from Baghdad. Tina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we want to take a moment today to ask you to consider being spied on through your cell phone. Three Washington State families say someone has been able to hack into their cell phones and use the microphones and cameras to listen in on their conversations and watch their every move. They say they get eerie voicemail messages from callers who describe what they're wearing, what they're doing, and threatening messages like this one. You could hear the caller say, "You are so dead." The family says the caller can make it appear the messages come from other family phones or from a restricted phone. They can make their phones call each other, even when no one's using them, and can turn the phones on even when they're powered off. 16-year-old Courtney Kuykendall noticed her phone was being used to spy on her in February. Her mother, Heather, joins us on the line from their home outside Tacoma. Heather, how disturbing is this?
Oh, it's like living in a nightmare. It's a bad dream. It's a scary movie, and we're living it. It's not funny. We can't take it lightly, the messages that we get. Some of them are very juvenile. However, there are a lot that aren't, and they are explicit on how they want to kill us, murder us, slice our throats.
Now, do I understand, is it your sister's family also that's getting some of the calls?
Yes, my sister and her family, he's in the military, he's getting calls, his phone has been compromised. My whole extended family, my elderly parents, and it's really, you know, worrying on them, and my daughter and several of her friends from school.
Yeah, the caller threatens to kill your parents' pets, Ike and Plumpy. Let's listen, in fact, to a call that was sent to your parents. Know where you live, I'm going to kill Ike and Plumpy, the family pets. Well, we understand that message came through while you were at the police department. First of all, tell me about that, because I understand, you know, you can have your phone just on off, mm-hmm. and the message will still come.
Yeah, we can power off our phones, and they can enable them and turn them back on. They power them back on, and they can change ringtones, they can add ringtones. They can call. Sometimes the phone won't even ring, and then we'll have a new message, and it'll be from them. They can pretty much take over our phones and do what we want. That message, yes, we were standing in the Tacoma police station when we received that and several other calls. They stated that they knew we're at the Tacoma Police Department and to get out because there's going to be a shooting there, too.
And how do the police treat this?
At first, they just think it's a juvenile, just teenage pranks. Some of my daughter's friends, oh, they're just pranking you. And I don't think they took it real seriously. But, you know, I know that once they maybe heard that my brother-in-law, he's, you know, in the military and his phone was compromised, then Homeland Security got involved, the FBI was involved.
Homeland Security's gotten involved and they haven't been able to solve this?
No. From what we heard, we were told that Homeland Security was involved, and that's pretty much all we've been told. I don't know how involved they've been.
What about the phone companies? What do they say? Why can't they block this?
That's what I asked them. All you need to do is have a feature, like we do on our home phones, that you can block calls from restricted calls coming in or blocked calls. However, they still have a way to get in now. Even if on our home phone it's blocked, we don't accept blocked calls anymore, but they still can get in, and they leave us text to landline messages now, and the phone number that comes up on our caller ID is my daughter's cell phone number, or mine, or even my husband's.
They make it appear that you're sending messages to each other.
Exactly.
We're going to talk to a security expert in a moment to hear more about the technology behind this. But meantime, what are you doing to try to stop it yourself?
Well, you know, we take our batteries out of our phones. That's the only way to stop it. We've taken my daughter's cell phone away, which she's not happy about. She's a teenager, typical. But, you know, we give our kids cell phones for security reasons, for emergency purposes. However, it's just backfired, and we don't feel protected. Sprint hasn't backed us up or supported us whatsoever. They just deny that this is possible, that this can even happen.
Would you ever give up all the cell phones?
we will be giving up the phones that we have. And as a matter of fact, I just got my disconnection notice from Sprint yesterday in the mail. So I've told them I won't be paying my bill. We might take a break from cell phones for a while, and I don't know what we're going to do. I'm not sure.
I know you put tape over your cell phone to try to keep the camera phone from working, but right. It would seem as if you have pretty good proof that they can see you. What are some of the things they've told you that they have seen that you feel it's legitimate because there's no way they could have seen it?
Oh, there's so many examples. I'll give you one. My daughter had some pearl earrings on our countertop in our kitchen, and they were all the way back against the backsplash. They called and said for her to get, and they swear a lot, and I'm not going to tell you exactly what they said, but they said to get her earrings off the counter. And so they make comments of things that are always on our counters, in our kitchen. If we sit up on the counter, they tell us to get off the counter, quit sitting on the counter. They describe things all around our home. They described what my younger daughter was wearing, what her T-shirt said, what my son was eating. I mean, just tiny, minor little things that you would have to zoom in on to be able to see in our home.
Do you think your house is bugged?
You know, I'm not saying it couldn't be. It could be. But I think if it is, it's both. It's definitely both. They aren't just getting it from a bugged phone, because I will tell you, this has happened in places where when we haven't been home. Mm-hmm. We've been outside our home, mm-hmm. and they've told us what we're doing, where we are.
Do you think there are some people who don't think you're telling the truth? Because it's so unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, and I know there's those people out there. And that's what's frustrating, because Sprint didn't even believe that we were telling the truth. Or the police, I think, probably think we're a little wacko, you know. We're just a normal American family, and, you know, this happened to us. And I know we didn't go to the media right away for more than one reason. We were advised not to by the police. But we felt like we need to get it out here and take the chance that people might not believe us. But it's been so nice since we have come out and let people know about this, how much support we've had and how possible this is. You spend 5 minutes Googling this, you can find out how common this is and how it can happen.
Have you heard from other people who've said they've had it happen to them?
We have found two other families that this has happened to. One I haven't been in contact with personally, but another family we have, they live within an hour of us. One lives real close to us. The interesting thing is we all have teenage daughters.
Do you worry about your safety?
We go back and forth. We think, okay, maybe it is just pranks and they're harmless. But then when it's nighttime and you hear banging on your doors and you're getting these death threats, these phone calls constantly, nonstop, it's scary. And we've had home security system put in our home. We got all new locks put on. Locksmith came, changed out all our keys. We're having our home sweeped inside and out to check for bugs. And so we're doing what we can, but I don't know what else there is we can do.
Heather Kuykendall and two other families in the Tacoma, Washington area say they're being harassed by someone through their own cell phones. Heather, thanks so much, and good luck to you. I think you've had everybody thinking twice about cell phones.
Oh, never look at them the same again.
Well, just ahead, we'll have a response from Sprint. We'll also speak to a surveillance expert who says, yes, this is happening, and he'll tell us how to prevent it. Back after a quick break, here and now. It's here and now, and we've been hearing a story out of Washington State, a family claiming someone has hacked into their cell phones and is using the phones to spy on them. Now, Sprint told us that they're unaware of a technology that can do this, but James Atkinson is a counter-surveillance expert and president of the Granite Island Group, an electronics engineering company that specializes in hunting spies, and he joins us now. And Jim, you just heard Heather Kuykendall's story. Your response?
Well, I think what she's saying is completely credible, and quite frankly, I believe everything she said.
Is it possible for someone to take control of your cell phone, to turn on your camera, for instance, and see through your cell phone camera from another location, from their cell phone?
Yes, it's completely possible, completely plausible, can be easily done, easily demonstrated, and is actually a very common prank that some of the younger kids tend to do these days. Yes, and to put it quite bluntly, Sprint knows that this can be done. They've had numerous complaints of this happening in the past.
Well, we will call Sprint and get a reaction to those comments. But you say this is software. So we had heard that there was software that was being sold online that you get on the Internet, and a lot of spouses were using it to spy on their spouses through the cell phone. So we had heard that the software was available. Can you do this without the software? Can you just hack into cell phones?
Yes. Typically what's done is the spy will bait the victim to go to a website of some sort and download a fragment of what's called Java code. And that Java code is essentially a Trojan horse that allows them to seize control of their phone and to put additional software into their phone, much like a computer virus.
How might somebody do that? How could somebody, well, we all get spam, and we try not to open the emails that say download this, but how might, this have happened?
Well, people don't seem to understand that the cell phone which they have in their hands is actually a very sophisticated computer. There's a lot of viruses and Trojan horses available for cell phones, but people don't realize there's virtually nothing they can do to put virus detection software on their cell phone.
Well, yeah, we know you shared concerns about the Kuykendall's daughter, that she has a MySpace page, and she shares a lot of information on it. A lot of kids do that. How might someone have used MySpace to get control of her cell phone?
Somebody can place a spam or a link into her MySpace comment section as if they were signing a guest book. So the person is actually putting up a link to a picture or a ringtone or something of that nature. And when the victim clicks on the link to listen to the really cool ringtone, it's actually transmitting a virus into the phone, and that mechanism allows them to seize control of the phone.
When you say if this person was linking to listen to the ringtone, you mean if she was looking at MySpace on her cell phone?
That's correct.
What are some of your other concerns about this particular story? I know you've looked into it, and it would just be speculative at this point, but what are some of your other concerns?
Well, the other people who apparently are also victims, other than the adult victims, they also have MySpace pages. They are also linked to Courtney's page, and there are some concerns with that because it's very easy to see who her social circle of friends are. One of the concerns is that Courtney's pretending to be a 19-year-old female when in fact she was 14 or 15 years old when she set this up.
We've gone to the page, and, and while Courtney does say that buried in the page later, she says, well, I'm really not 19.
That's a very dangerous game that she's playing, though.
How would you go about catching someone doing this?
First thing that we have to look at is there's the cell phone tower, and then there's the actual cell phone itself that the person holds in their hand. Now, people in our profession have test equipment that can electronically measure everything that the phone does and every communication that goes between the phone to the cell phone tower. By analyzing that data, we can see what is really going on between the cell phone itself and the cell phone tower, because these messages aren't just coming in from Mars, they're coming in from a cell phone tower. So the first thing that you have to do is find out where these messages are actually originating from.
Given all of that, though, it is possible. It is possible to find out who's making these calls. Why hasn't it been done?
The problem is the technology is there to track this down, but most law enforcement agencies, they don't have the equipment, they don't know the equipment exists, they don't know how to program in Java. It's not within the scope of their technical training.
Right, and we understand your services could cost a police department from $50,000 to $100,000?
Easily.
So, and by the way, when you mentioned the Java, which is the code, we understand that at the high school some of these young people go to, they're taught how to write that code.
Oh, absolutely. That particular school actually teaches Java programming. So you can actually go to a class at the school to learn how to do this.
So in the meantime, given that the Kuykendalls probably can't afford your services either, what do you recommend that they do?
Go to Sprint. Tell Sprint you want all data-related services turned off on their account, so that all they have is a regular, ordinary cell phone that can be used to talk to other people but can do nothing else, and the problem will stop. The big problem is that this is a fairly new phenomenon. Cell phones have gotten extraordinarily powerful in the last few years, and the phones are very easy to program by anybody with access to Java.
So we will be hearing about this more.
Oh, it's going to get a lot worse in the next few years.
James Atkinson of the Granite Island Group, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Glad to help.
And this quick note, we spoke to Sprint again, and they said they are working with law enforcement in Washington State on the Kuykendall case, but they say they've received no other complaints of cell phones being used to spy on people, and they said again, they're not aware of technology that could allow a phone's camera to be remotely activated, though it may or may not be possible to listen in on someone through their cell phone. Well, meanwhile, the Commerce Department warns on its website that a cell phone can be turned into a listening device. For more on that, go to our website, here-now.org. Taking a look ahead to tomorrow, NPR's Rob Gifford joins us to trace the social and economic revolution turning China upside down. And we're going to fact-check a few of the claims made by Michael Moore in his new film, Sicko. That's tomorrow. And still ahead, the Supreme Court rules, including siding with a high school principal who suspended a student who held up that banner saying, "Bong hits for Jesus." The student lost. Back after the news, here and now. Support for Hearing. It's Here and Now, and we have several significant 5-4 rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court today, including two decisions seen as being in favor of the Bush administration and a blow against the landmark campaign finance reform law. It also seems there's been a strike against free speech rights for students. In one of those two wins for the Bush administration, the High Court barred ordinary taxpayers, in this case a group of atheists and agnostics, from challenging the White House's faith-based initiative. In the second, the court sided with the administration in a dispute with environmentalists over protecting endangered species. Lyle Denniston covers the court for SCOTUSblog.com. He joins us now. And, Lyle, let's start with the faith-based initiative suit. How did the court rule?
The Supreme Court ruled that the people who pay their federal taxes do not have a right to come to court and complain because the White House is diverting federal funds to groups that are set up along faith-based lines to provide social services.
And the significance, of course, is what?
The significance is that the federal courthouse is largely closed, I think, to any of the groups. This was an activist group that supports separating government and religion to bring lawsuits to try to stop the White House faith-based initiative. Mm-hmm. In other words, that program is allowed to go on because it will be very difficult to find anybody after today who would be in a position to bring a challenge.
Okay, the second one, the Supreme Court sided with the Bush administration in a dispute with environmentalists over protecting endangered species.
A federal agency, in this case the Fish and Wildlife Service, had one law that generally governs what it does, and the question was, does the Endangered Species Act override the other statute? So it's basically a technical ruling that does, however, cut back on the protective capacity of the Endangered Species Act.
This was a suit that was brought by the National Association of Home Builders.
You know, generally business, particularly home builders and construction people, are very reluctant to obey the Endangered Species Act, and this gives them a kind of a free pass.
Well, there were other rulings today that we'd been also looking for. One of them had to do with campaign ads, the court loosening restrictions on those ads, restrictions that were put in place by the campaign finance reform law. So can you just remind us, what were the restrictions and how has the Supreme Court loosened them?
This is under a law that Congress passed in 2002, which forbids anybody to put a radio and TV ad on the air 30 days before a federal primary or 60 days before an election day, general election, if the ad mentions a person who is running for Senate or House or President. The court ruled today that essentially anybody who wants to air that kind of an ad has a right to do so long as they don't say explicitly vote for or vote against that person.
So in other words, the practice of, let's say, a special interest group doing an ad about an issue, not necessarily about a campaign, might in their ad about an issue, let's say choice or abortion, anti-abortion ads, they might mention how a candidate stands on that issue.
Yeah, as long as they throw into the ad a reference to a current public policy issue, in this case it was a Senate filibustering of federal judicial nominees, as long as they throw in some kind of a policy message, they have a First Amendment right, the court ruled today, to mention the name of a candidate who's running, even if they do this just before a primary or a general election. And I think, generally speaking, what the dissent said is probably true, that this tends to gut that part of the 2002 campaign finance law that attempted to restrict these ads so close to election time.
All right. The other ruling today, also 5-4, some would read as a blow against students' free speech rights. Others would see as supporting school rights. It's the case of the high school student in Alaska who was suspended for unfurling that banner as the Olympic torch, I believe, was passing by. The banner said, "Bong hits for Jesus." The student said he was just trying to get some, you know, camera time, and the principal tore the banner out of his hands. So what did the Supreme Court say?
Well, the court ruled today, again, 5-4. There were four 5-4 decisions today. In this case, the court said that the school officials do have the authority to discipline a student who promotes a drug use at a school event. The court was very clear in saying that it only applies when it's a school event discussing drug use. They rejected an argument by the Bush administration that school officials should be able to punish students any time they said anything that interfered with the school's educational mission. So the court's majority did attempt to confine it to a school event where the student is talking about promoting drug use.
Well, so how did this particular student fare? How do you read that? Because we understood he was outside of the school, but it was an assembly of students to watch the torch.
The whole premise of the court's decision today, Robin, is that this was a school event.
Okay.
So that's what the law now limits, even though the boy and others have argued that since he was across the street, it was not a school event. But the court goes through the facts of the case and concludes that it was. And what's important about that is that in interpreting the facts as they have today, they have, in essence, laid down a legal rule that it must be a school event, no matter what the facts say. It's mm-hmm. got to be something that the school sponsored and monitored and kept the teachers on the staff alert to what the students were doing.
And finally, Lyle, all these rulings, as we've been saying, 5-4 decisions. So this, I'm sure, reinforces some thinking. What is that thinking?
Well, I think everybody is inclined to say that the appointment of Justice Samuel Alito to replace Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has made a world of difference in the court, and so that her centrist vote, which often was controlling in the years when she was in the court, has now become a very solid vote for the conservative, what appears to be a conservative majority on a lot of these high visibility social issues. So it's clear that that made more difference than the appointment of Chief Justice Roberts to replace Chief Justice Rehnquist, because I think probably Rehnquist would have been in the majority in all of these four cases today, just as the Chief Justice Roberts was.
Right. Well, we're still awaiting two cases involving race-based public school admissions that may come later this week. But a quick look ahead. The court is looking to its term next year and has announced four cases it's going to take for review. And I understand one of those references the O.J. Simpson case.
This is a case where a prosecutor used all of his maneuvering to get an all-white jury to try a black man on a charge of murdering his estranged wife's boyfriend. And as part of the argument to the jury in favor of giving this man a death sentence after he was convicted, the prosecutor made obvious references to the O.J. Simpson case. He didn't mention O.J.'s name, but he made it very clear that he was talking about that case out in California where the suspect fled from police in a white Bronco and got away with it. So the argument that's being made by a public defender in the appeal to the Supreme Court is that this is a form of injecting the pernicious effects of racial prejudice into a jury in Louisiana trying a black man before an all-white jury.
Okay.
Yeah, and Robin, we will probably get the school cases as well as another important death penalty case on Thursday.
Lyle Denniston, covering the Supreme Court for SCOTUSblog.com. Thanks as always.
I'm glad to be with you, Robin. Bye.
Okay, before we go today, how life and love change for a group of privileged New Yorkers in the wake of 9/11. Claire Masood's The Emperor's Children out in paperback. You're listening to Here and Now. Time to hear some of your thoughts. We spoke last week with Dr. Jerome Groopman, author of How Doctors Think, about the medical school mindset he says leads to bad diagnoses. Well, I shared one of my own. I was falsely diagnosed with Addison's disease. That's a failure of the adrenal glands, the major symptom being extreme fatigue. And John Magura of Doylestown, Pennsylvania, sent this sobering reminder that a misdiagnosis may not be as bad as missed diagnoses. He writes, "My 26-year-old brother, James Gerard Magura, died from Addison's disease because two doctors failed to properly diagnose him. He saw them in the fall and was dead in January. Addison's can be fatal, as you reported, when you're pregnant or in an accident, but it also kills if it's not identified and treated on time. Thanks for letting me get the word out." Well, D.B. Reif of Brighton, Massachusetts, also wrote, "After our report on a study out of Oregon's Portland State University, which showed that male veterans are twice as likely to commit suicide as their non-veteran peers." D.B. writes, "Willa Cather wrote about veterans in her 1922 Pulitzer Prize-winning World War I novel, One of Ours. She writes, "One by one, they quietly die by their own hand. Some do it in obscure lodging houses, some in their office. Some slip over a vessel's side and disappear into the sea." DB continues, "We've known about veteran suicide for a long time. We just don't do much about it." Well, Dr. Barbara Romberg is trying. She's the D.C. woman we spoke with who started the Give 1 Hour Project, encouraging other psychologists to donate at least a free hour of counseling for returning more vets to make up for the deficit of mental health care in the military. The Reverend Larry Hansen of Portland, Oregon, wrote after our conversation to say, "While I have great respect for Dr. Romberg, I can't help but wonder if this isn't just another example of a small community of people bearing the burdens of a national crisis. If the cost of this terrible mistake was shared with a truly objective draft and a healthy tax increase to pay for the war, the great majority of our citizens would be ready to take to the streets in protest. Right now, we are voyeurs at best." Okay, a few other items. Carla Palau of Medford, Massachusetts, sent us to the dictionary. She writes, "Use the word foundering to describe John McCain's campaign. I think he meant to say floundering, which means to proceed clumsily and in confusion, unlike foundering, which refers to a disease of a horse's hoof." Oh, no, the whole floundering thing. Steve Kleinedler, senior editor of American Heritage, is on the line. Steve, flounder, founder. Difference?
There's a slight difference. They can both be used as verbs. In our American Heritage Guide to Contemporary Usage and Style, we say that the verb founder ultimately comes from the Latin word fundus, meaning bottom, and originally referred to knocking enemies down. And in nautical use, it would then mean to sink to the bottom.
Ah.
This word is extended to mean to fail utterly or collapse.
Okay. Flounder, in addition to the fish.
Yes. Flounder means to move clumsily or thrash about and therefore to proceed in confusion.
So to be really precise, buildings and campaigns can founder or collapse and people can flounder around like fish and be confused.
That is absolutely correct.
And a horse can founder if they come up lame.
That is also correct.
Okay. Steve, thanks as always.
Thanks. I'm glad I could help you sort it out.
By the way, Carla, who raised the question, adds, "Your show is the highlight of my otherwise monotonous day. I make crowns and bridges out of porcelain." To which we reply, "Carla, she also serves who stands and makes teeth." And finally, summer songs and sounds. Mark Scott loved the new book and CD, Songs of Insects, from Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger. He writes, "Felt like I was back in Washington, D.C., sweltering on the hottest evening of the cicada summer, with a great book in my hand, thanks." And for Mel Shacken of Williamsville, Vermont, it was Madeline Peru's version of Summer Wind.
"It's a beautiful sunny day in Vermont, a perfect temperature. And when you played that song, Summer Wind, it sort of evoked a lot of feelings in me. And I just wanted to let you know how wonderful it was for the first day of summer."
So what about you? Send your thoughts to letters@here-now.org or call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. After the break, Claire Masood's post-9/11 novel, The Emperor's Children, Here and Now.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea and lingered there
Morning, It's Here and Now. Writer Claire Massoud's acclaimed novel, The Emperor's Children, is set in Manhattan, largely pre-9/11. 30-something friends Marina, Danielle, and Julius met in college and are vaguely alarmed that their time for being special is running out. Marina is an aspiring writer, but she's also the daughter of celebrated liberal journalist Murray Thwaite. In this scene, Murray, daughter Marina on his arm, enters a ceremony in his honor, observed by his daughter's best friend, Danielle, who will soon become his mistress.
In this Hollywood version of Old New York, Marina and Murray advanced with the authority, the noblesse oblige, of leading players. An insignificant subset of society it might be. Danielle cast a skeptical eye over the assembled writers and journalists, a rumpled and bulging lot, even in their finery. But the Thwaites nevertheless had dominion over it. Oh, to be so easy.
Into this glittering world wanders Booty, Murray's nephew, like a slacker crashing a Vanity Fair party, the only one who seems to see that everyone is fiddling while Rome burns. And indeed, in the final pages, two planes hit the World Trade Towers and all of their little lives are changed. The Emperor's Children is being released in paperback this week and has been optioned by director Ron Howard's company for a possible film. We spoke with Claire when the novel first came out and asked her about Murray Thwaite, a character sometimes oblivious to those around him, yet beloved and justly renowned.
I think he's somebody who in his youth was pretty daring and ambitious and did a lot of original things. And then as he has grown older, he's 60 at the time the novel takes place, I think he's become an establishment figure and is somewhat wedded to his myth and society's myth about him.
A little bit maybe of a bloviator, although he thinks he might be, which makes him more interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
He has a little self-awareness.
Well, there's another character we haven't mentioned, Ludovic Seely. He comes to New York from Australia to start up a revolutionary magazine to take down people he perceives as blowhards, such as the aforementioned Murray Thwaite. And he marries Thwaite's daughter. Who is he in this mix? Who do you see in him?
In my mind, it's a generational clash between him and Murray. In part, an inevitable one. You feel you have to slay the fathers, you know, but also actually a philosophical one. My own moment at university, I'm a little older than these characters, but it was the moment when literary theory was very popular, and it was in tension, I think, with received liberal humanist understanding. So the idea that a work of literature was good, a literary theorist calls that into question. What does good mean?
Yeah.
What is good?
And Ludovic, I think somebody wrote, and maybe you did, he thinks truth is fungible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I did.
Yes, you did. Okay. And so there he is sort of shaking up everyone's lives. But would you, and I had the luxury of reading this not knowing that all of them were heading towards 9/11
mm-hmm.
and thinking, wow, they think things are important. You know, in my post 9/11 mind reading this thinking, they don't feel that important.
Yes. You know, I started this book early in 2001, and it was a book set in contemporary New York. And I was having trouble a little bit with the tone of it because it was hard for me not to be somewhat detached from my characters and a little bit knowing. It seemed important somehow to let people know that I wasn't preoccupied with the same things as my characters, or not entirely. And in some way, the momentous historical moment of 9/11, it made me leave the novel for some time. But when I came back to it, I felt I had more sympathy for my characters because they seemed suddenly caught in history. The people they were, that was over, that moment had ended. And all the things they took so seriously, none of us could take seriously anymore. And that seemed poignant rather than pathetic.
Well, and in fact, Ludovic Seely, for instance, and his now wife, Marina, Murray Thwaite's daughter, the magazine they were about to launch, you know, makes no sense. How can a magazine be revolution when they just saw someone else's idea of revolution crashing into the towers?
Right, right. For me as a fiction writer, I think for lots of people in the time right after 9/11, it was very hard to see the purpose of what a lot of us do. As I remember, it was very much a poetry moment. You know, prose somehow didn't fit the bill, but poetry, there was a... The lyric somehow could capture something of what people were experiencing in that time. But it was a very strange time because you did actually wonder, will anybody do them again?
Well, and in fact, you sum that up in the character Danielle, who has a point of view of this from her window. She can see the World Trade Towers when they're attacked. Let's listen.
She had seen the second plane like a gleaming arrow and the burst of it, oddly beautiful against the blue, and the smoke everywhere, and she had seen the people jumping from afar, specks in the sky, and she knew that's what they were only from the TV, from the great reality check of the screen, and she had seen the buildings crumble to dust. She could smell them, even inside, even with the windows sealed, the asbestos, smoke, gasoline fuel, slight airplane, slight bonfire reek of it. She had seen these things and had been left forever, because in light of these things she did not matter. You had to make the right choice. You had to stay on the ground. But, God, the sky last night had been gorgeous, the colors, the lights, the towers, and after she let go of her terror, the joy of it. You had to stay on the ground, and there was no call to feel anything. There was nothing to feel, because you weren't worth anything to anyone. You'd had your heart, or was it your guts, or both, taken out. You'd been eviscerated. That was the word. And the Spanish woman singing last night, she had known. She had known all along. And now there was nothing but sorrow, and this was how it was going to be now, always.
The Spanish woman was the music that she was listening to the night before. We don't want to tell which character it is, Claire Massou, but one of them is thought to die in the events of 9/11, but doesn't. Instead, moves away and starts a new life. And as I was reading that, I thought, well, that could be cruel to 9/11 families who might still be holding out that maybe some fairy tale like that happened for them. And then I thought, well, no, wait a minute. Maybe this is also a wonderful metaphor about rebirth or something. What were you saying there?
The initial impulse for it came from a piece I read in the New York Times that actually I think there were a certain number of people who did take that opportunity to disappear. Mm-hmm. And it was known from their credit card use and their and so on that they didn't actually die, but they didn't go home to their families. Mm-hmm. But it's also true that for me, the character who does this, it perhaps sounds portentous or something to say so, but the character is the most American. Even though everybody's American except Ludovic Seely, but this character is the most American and in some way the most resilient, and in my mind is the survivor. In that sense, it did seem to me a note of, if not optimism, that might be too strong, I don't know, but certainly of some way through this terrible time, that there is a spirit that can't be kept down.
In fact, this character says, this is such an enormous amount of evil, maybe you could use this kind of hugeness for good or something. I'm trying to remember what the character...
It's about translating something from inside your head into the outside world. The idea that this had just been an idea in somebody's head. But what if you had an idea that was as powerful and a good idea? What would that be?
I want to quickly mention the title, The Emperor's Children. It refers, of course, to the emperor having no clothes. And I'm thinking Murray Thwaite was sort of emperor-ish, and the book is in part about his child. But also it's about her book, which is somewhat hilarious in that sort of pre-9/11 way that she's agonizing over the book she's writing about.
About children's fashions and what they say about our culture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you making fun of any of them, really, in with the things that they agonized over before 9/11?
No. I think it's hard when you care about people, even if you see them as making odd or frivolous choices, it's hard to make fun of them entirely. I feel I care a lot about these people I made up, and they feel like my relatives at this point. So I feel sometimes bemused by them or sad for them, or, you know, I have lots of reactions, but I don't think I'm making fun of them.
Novelist Claire Massou, her book The Emperor's Children comes out in paperback tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.